Case number 13-1069 et al. National Association of Manufacturers Petitioners versus Environmental Protection Agency and Gina McCarthy, Administrator, EPA. Mr. Wareham for the petitioners, Mr. Hostetler for the respondents.
May it please the court. My name is Bill Wareham, counsel for petitioners, United States Chamber of Commerce, National Association of Manufacturers, Utility or Regulatory Group, and PM NACS Coalition. Your Honors, this case involves EPA's decision to revise the annual National Ambient Air Quality Standard for fine particles, so-called PM 2.5, from a level of 15 micrograms per cubic meter to 12 micrograms per cubic meter. We assert that EPA's decision was invalid for three fundamental reasons. First, we believe that EPA unlawfully prejudged the outcome of this proceeding by not taking comment on the possibility that the current 15 microgram standard remains requisite to protect public health with an adequate margin of safety. Second, we assert that EPA failed to consider key comments submitted to the record and arbitrarily weighed comparable comments differently in making the decision. Third, we believe that EPA failed to issue rules that are necessary for the implementation of the standard that it adopted, the 12 microgram standard, and that adopting the standard without those rules in place was an arbitrary and capricious decision that was not in accord with the law. In addition to the three fundamental arguments, Your Honors, we also addressed two other more narrow issues. One was EPA's decision to eliminate so-called spatial averaging, a method of determining compliance with the National Ambient Air Quality Standard. We believe that EPA's decision to eliminate spatial averaging was arbitrary and capricious. And we allege that EPA's decision to require roadside monitoring for PM 2.5 for purposes of determining compliance with the NACS was arbitrary and capricious and procedurally flawed. I'll address each of those issues in turn, Your Honors. First of all, EPA unlawfully prejudged the outcome of this proceeding. In implementing its statutory obligation under Section 109B1, the agency is required to do two things. First of all, the agency must determine whether the existing standard remains requisite to protect public health with an adequate margin of safety. And if the agency decides the answer to that question is no, the agency must decide at what new level the standard should be set at.
Didn't we say in Mississippi, though, that the agency is not required to stick with the old one? There's no special obligation to give precedence to the old standard.
Judge Kavanaugh, we believe Mississippi stands for the proposition that the agency is not required to prove a negative, which is reassess all of the science that was considered in setting the prior standard and refute science that it no longer believes would support that standard. Our assertion is, the agency is making the current decision on the basis of the current factual record, which includes some information that was available previously, but some information that has become available since then. So with the benefit of all of the available information, including the most newly available information, the agency must make the decision as to whether the current standard is requisite. So what we're arguing is distinguishable and distinct from what we believe the holding in Mississippi to be.
I guess I, more broadly, combining, I guess, your first and second points, there's a lot of studies here and a lot of information, and KSAC has recommended what it's recommended. So I'm having trouble seeing how EPA could be deemed to have acted unlawfully in setting it at 12, given all the information in this case. They could have set it at a different number, sure. I think that would be okay as well, but I'm not sure how we can second guess this.
Well, we believe that's part of the problem with what EPA did, Your Honor. EPA repeatedly waves its hands and refers to the weight of the evidence and waves its hands and refers to the hundreds and thousands of studies and other bits of evidence that are available to it to make a decision. But ultimately, it must make the decision on the basis of the information in front of it. And for instance, our point number two is we cited to a number of studies and comments submitted to the record in support of arguments, for instance, that EPA's belief that there is a link between PM2.5 exposure and mortality is flawed, and EPA's belief that there's no threshold below which PM2.5 exposure results in harm. We believe there are studies that refute that conclusion.
But EPA's answer to that is, you know, we looked at those studies that you cite. D.C. Circuit case law makes very clear we don't have to discuss every study, and generically we explain why, based on the science, the evidence in the record, the agency concluded that there was a link between fine PM and mortality and why it was not a threshold drug. I mean, that's the EPA's answer. And given our standard review, why isn't that a pretty persuasive response?
Your Honor, two reasons. Uh-huh. First of all, the Mississippi case that Judge Kavanaugh referred to earlier stands for the proposition that sometimes it doesn't take very many studies to sway the agency's opinion or to sway the court's opinion. In Mississippi, one of the issues on which the court found a flaw was EPA's failure to consider short-term studies in deciding where to set the annual NAAQS for PM2.5. And in that case, only a handful of short-term studies were cited as being relevant to the court's decision. So, yes, there are hundreds and thousands of bits of information and studies out there, but a limited number of studies are the studies that can make or break the difference between the agency's decision. So again, the agency waving its hand at the weight of the evidence is not sufficient. You know, if a study is submitted to the comment record and if it's argued the study is relevant to a key issue in the decision making, which we argued on the record, we believe the agency has an obligation to respond to that argument and respond to that study. And part two, Your Honor, is it's not just a good idea. The Clean Air Act includes very precise notice and comment requirements. And 112D6 says that the agency must respond in the final rule to data submitted to the record during the comment period. We submitted data to the record. There's no evidence in the record that the agency responded to a number of the studies that we cited in support of the arguments we were making. And we believe that's a fundamental flaw. The agency failed to satisfy its obligation under Section 112D6. If I could move on, Your Honor, one other problem here in this section of our argument is we also believe the agency applied different standards in considering the studies that it did address. The agency admittedly in the rulemaking said we're putting greater weight on studies that show statistically significant relationships between PM exposure and various harmful health impacts such as mortality. We argued in comments to the record that studies that show no statistically significant relationship are equally valuable and equally probative in deciding whether PM2.5 is causing these effects, and if so, at what level the standard should be set.
Well, the Commission's response to EPA's response to that is we did look at all those studies. We looked at everything. We looked at statistically significant stuff. We looked at stuff that was not statistically significant. We looked at stuff that showed no relationship when we were making our causation finding. It was only when we got to setting the actual PM standard that we confined ourselves to statistically significant studies. That's their answer. And is that wrong? When they say we considered all of the evidence statistically significant or not, is that false?
Your Honor, you're correct. The agency in the rulemaking asserted to have bifurcated its decision to first have looked at the causation, as you just explained, and then second, having concluded causation exists, made a separate inquiry into where the level should be set.
And we have cases saying that that's an appropriate way to proceed.
Right, but our argument, Your Honor, and I apologize for interrupting, our argument, Your Honor, is that it's inappropriate, even in setting the level of the standard, for the agency to place greater weight on statistically significant studies and to ignore the many studies that show no statistically significant relationship. So that we believe the agency's rationale is arbitrary because there's no reason, even at the point of setting the level of the standards, to place greater emphasis on certain studies and less emphasis on others.
Well, conflicting studies, they have to make a choice.
And this is where the weighing of the evidence comes in. So the agency does have a body of information in front of it, and the agency must make a decision based on that body. And what we're saying is it's considering certain of the information to have greater value than other information, and we say that's arbitrary.
So what about the fact that CASAC seems to justify what the agency did here down the line pretty much?
CASAC gives advice. CASAC doesn't promulgate rules, Your Honor. And yes, the agency
totally
must.
I completely agree with that. But the idea that they acted arbitrarily in weighing scientific evidence or studies becomes a bit of an uphill climb for you when CASAC, and I'm with you on over-reliance on CASAC, but it does become an uphill climb.
Well, the statute specifies, as I'm sure you know, that if the administrator decides to depart from the advice of CASAC, the administrator may do so, but has to provide an explanation as to why it does. So CASAC's advice is meaningful and necessary to the process. But I didn't mean to be flip earlier. Part of what's happening here in this NAAQS review and another NAAQS reviews is so much of the process is front-loaded. The criteria document was done 3 years before the regulatory decision was made. So EPA effectively cut off consideration of certain science. CASAC's advice was given months and years before the regulatory decision was made. So part of what we're arguing is the rubber hits the road when EPA proposes and promulgates a decision on whether to change the standard, and if it decides to change the standard, at what level it should be set at. And the agency has obligations under the law of this court and obligations under the law of the Clean Air Act, Section 307, to meet minimum procedural and evidentiary requirements, and our simple point is it failed in many ways to do that.
Let me ask you this about your point about that it relied only on statistically significant. Do you believe that a study that does not show a statistically significant level of causation is the same as no causation? Is that your point? Is that what you think? That if it's not statistically significant, then the study can be cited for the proposition that there's no causal relationship?
Your Honor, I would say it calls into question the existence of a relationship. And
well, look, suppose you have two studies. One statistically significant shows a relationship, and the other one shows a relationship, but it's not statistically significant. What would you do with that?
I would investigate the specifics of the studies, Your Honor. One that shows statistically significant results is not necessarily, does not necessarily provide evidence that a change has to be made. Because, for instance,
That's not my question. I'm just asking about these two studies.
Sure.
Because it sounds to me like your answer is what EPA did. It considered both of them, the statistically significant one and the one that wasn't statistically significant, took a look at both, and made a judgment supported by CASAC that this was sufficient evidence make a finding of causation. Now, maybe the one that showed that wasn't statistically significant, provided a little uncertainty, but, as we've said over and over again, EPA is regulating here in an area of great uncertainty.
Your Honor. And our argument is EPA put a thumb on the scale.
By doing what exactly?
By placing...
relying on statistically...
Yes, I'm sorry, Your Honor. By placing greater reliance on studies showing statistically significant results than those that don't.
Uh-huh. And just one more time. And your response to EPA's statement that we looked at all the studies is they did at stage one, but not at stage two. Right? So your point is that I want to make sure I understand your argument. Even at the level setting, the NAAQS setting process, at that stage, they had to take account of studies that did not show statistically.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe it's arbitrary to decide that certain studies have greater weight and to place less weight on studies that don't show the relationships that they use as the basis for.
No, we're not talking about the relationship here. We're talking about setting the level of the NAAQS.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Well, go ahead.
On the thumb on the scale point, if there are multiple places where you could set the level or set the standard such that it was requisite, and we've said that choosing among those is an exercise of policy judgment by the agency, why aren't they allowed to, in essence, have a thumb on the scale in the direction of their policy inclination?
Because we believe it's arbitrary treatment of the evidence before the agency, Your Honor.
What I'm saying is wading through conflicting evidence and figuring out and then setting a level, a standard that you think is requisite, strikes me that you're going to have a range of reasonable possibilities, and obviously different agencies in different eras are going to have different inclinations on that, and I don't know that we can get in the middle of that.
And we're not asking this court to get into the middle of that, Your Honor. We're simply asking that the agency be required to be even-handed in considering the evidence when it makes decisions, and we assert that it has not been. Now, Your Honors, I am already a little bit over time, but if I may, I would like to address a couple of our other
arguments. Actually, it's not a little bit. You are over time, but you can take, why don't you just take 2 more minutes so you can make your other points.
Thank you, Judge Tatel. Thank you. Our other key argument to the validity of the standards overall is that EPA acted arbitrary and capriciously and not in accord with the law by choosing to adopt the revised standard and acknowledging when it adopted the revised standard that a wide range of rules and policy guidance would be necessary for the successful implementation of that standard, and yet not providing the rules and the guidance at the same time the standard was issued.
And your answer to EPA's argument that these are either unripe or you lack standing is what?
Your Honor, what's important is the agency itself is the one who said all this was needed. There's 15 pages of preamble discussion that goes to implementation where issue after issue after issue is raised by the agency, an explanation is provided as to why the issue needs to be addressed. For instance, a model to be able to...
I understand. What's your second point that you wanted to make?
Yes, Your Honor. We also had 2 other narrow issues. One, that EPA had arbitrarily and lawfully eliminated spatial averaging from the rule, a method of assessing data from multiple monitors in a given area. Our argument here is simple. We believe that the agency acted arbitrarily and capriciously in eliminating the ability to use spatial averaging in assessing the data from multiple monitors in a given area.
Right.
The reason, Your Honor, is in both 1997 and in 2006, the agency had considered the very same issues before the agency today, concerns about disproportional impact on certain sensitive subpopulations, and had crafted very narrowly tailored spatial averaging provisions that addressed the possibility of disproportionate impact and provided for a system that would prevent that from happening. There's nothing new under the sun here. Our argument in this rulemaking is the agency essentially raised the same concern, looked at essentially the same evidence that was available,
Okay. And
concluded in a manner that was not reasonably explained in the record that spatial monitoring should be eliminated in this case rather
okay.
than maintained.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge.
May it please the Court, Eric Hostetler for Respondent EPA. With me at Council's table are Steve Silverman and David Orlin. The EPA Administrator did exercise reasonable policy judgment in deciding to strengthen the primary annual national ambient air quality standard for PM2.5 so as to provide requisite public health protection. The Administrator provided a very well-reasoned and compelling explanation as to the considerations informing her decision to strengthen the standard. I'll focus my time on the decision to revise the standard level, and I can also briefly address the ancillary issues if you have questions. First of all, most obviously, the selected 12 microgram per cubic meter standard level is fully consistent with the unanimous explicit recommendation of the 22-member CASAC independent review panel. CASAC advised that the former standard of 15 was not protected. It advised that an annual standard within the range of 11 to 13 is supported by the body of epidemiologic and toxicologic evidence, and the selected standard of 12, of course, is right within the middle of that range. And as this court stated in Mississippi, and I will quote, surely the administrator may rely on an explicit recommendation by the unanimous CASAC panel, which is precisely the situation here. The administrator explained that the former standard of 15 is not protected, both because new scientific evidence provides more compelling evidence of causation of an association between PM2.5 and premature mortality and other serious adverse health effects, and because abundant new scientific evidence reflects that these serious adverse health effects are associated with exposure at lower concentrations, including concentrations at or below the former standard level of 15. In particular, the administrator pointed to numerous key short-term and long-term multi-city studies where the reported long-term mean concentration was at or below 15. The selected standard level of 12 is below the reported mean PM2.5 concentrations in those studies. And I should stress, this court has already upheld twice this same basic methodology of setting a level of the standard below long-term mean concentrations in key epidemiologic studies. The approach was upheld both upon review of the 1997 PM2.5 NAAQS and upon review of the 2006 NAAQS, although the latter was remanded on other grounds. So there's nothing new here. Likewise, this court, as recently as the Mississippi case, has expressly said that the EPA may permissibly consider statistical significance in deciding which studies to give the most weight to in setting the level of the standard. There were no procedural defects with either the scientific review process here or with the subsequent rulemaking, to the extent that petitioners are contending that somehow EPA scientific staff and the independent CASAC panel prejudged the science and didn't engage in a objective science review. That's unfounded and it's incorrect. The reality here is that the air quality criteria review process was extremely thorough, it was transparent, it was peer-reviewed, and it was credible. The criteria that EPA utilized in that process for identifying key studies was clearly explained at the outset of the integrated science assessment. And to the extent that EPA staff gave the most weight to particular studies, particular kinds of evidence, they reasonably explained their basis for doing so. The fact that petitioners disagree with the scientific conclusions reached in the air quality criteria doesn't reflect prejudgment. It reflects that these petitioners disagree with the scientific conclusions. But this court has made clear in numerous other cases involving NAAQS that its role is not to reweigh the air quality criteria, reweigh the science. Its role is simply to determine whether the administrator, based on that science, has made a reasonable policy judgment, and she has. Her decision easily meets the applicable deferential standard of review. Nor was there any defect in the opportunity for comment in the rulemaking. The administrator plainly invited comment on all issues. There are a full 4 pages in the federal rule, the proposed notice preamble, where she discusses the threshold issue of whether the existing standard is requisite or not. Petitioners weren't confused that they had an opportunity to comment on that issue. They submitted extensive comments arguing that the existing standard was requisite, and the administrator then responded to each and every industry comment. She explained issue by issue why each scientific judgment, each policy conclusion contested by industry was in fact well supported by the collective body of scientific evidence contained in the air quality criteria. That discussion spans dozens of pages in the federal rule preamble and response to comment document collectively. And the agency squarely addressed the two scientific conclusions that they contest in this litigation. The agency squarely addressed the mortality causation finding. The agency squarely addressed the issue of population level threshold. Does the court have any questions on her decision to revise the standard level?
Can you address the near-road monitoring?
Certainly, Your Honor. EPA did reasonably require that state monitoring networks include a limited number of PM2.5 monitors near heavily trafficked roads. National ambient air quality standards are just that. They are national standards. They provide protection to all members of the public, including those people who live, who work, who go to school, who play near major roads. These national standards aren't intended to provide protection only to those members of the public who are fortunate enough to live far away from a lot of traffic.
And what, what does the record tell us about that? What evidence in the record? What is the evidence in the record about large numbers of people living near?
Well, first I should emphasize that EPA's decision to require near road monitors wasn't dependent upon the precise number of people who live near roads. The point was to provide the intended protection of public health to those people who may be exposed to PM2.5 concentrations near major roads. That said, there was evidence submitted into the record, principally by environmental groups in their comments, that related to the number of people that are near major roads. The environmental groups pointed to Census Bureau data, which suggested that tens of millions of people live within very close proximity to major roads, and the environmental groups pointed to other data as well. They pointed to a Health Effects Institute study estimating that between 35% and 45% of the population lives within 5 miles.
Could you go back to your first answer tonight? You said the decision to put monitors near major roads was not based on the fact that people live near roads. Is that what you said?
In crafting a monitoring network, a principal objective of EPA is always to identify relatively high pollution areas. You're trying to find monitoring locations where there are going to be possible exposure in relatively high levels, because if you've got monitors in those areas, you can be reasonably confident that you don't need monitors everywhere. That's a way to create an efficient monitoring network. Moreover, you're trying to provide the intended protection of public health for everyone. You're not trying to have gaps in your monitoring network where there are going to be exceedances that you aren't monitoring, that you're overlooking. So here, it was eminently reasonable for EPA to fill what was basically a gap in its existing monitoring network by locating some monitors near heavily trafficked roads in major urban areas. And
where people live. And I thought your point was it didn't matter the precise number of people.
Right, it does.
As long as we're confident, or you're confident, that a substantial number of people.
We're confident that these are areas of possible population exposure, and the rules guarantee that, the way they're crafted. First of all, these monitors are only required in major urban areas with a population of greater than 1 million. Second, EPA has specifically required that these near-road monitors be representative of area-wide air quality to be compared to the annual max. And as that term has been defined, it means they can't be in unique hotspots. They have to be in locations that are representative of many, roadway locations. So you couldn't put a monitor, for example, next to a tunnel entrance or next to a major factory, and that might not be representative of area-wide air quality. So as EPA has crafted the regulations, they're going to be somewhat representative of population exposure. Moreover, EPA has specifically encouraged in the preamble state monitoring agencies to try to locate these monitors in places like housing complexes, schools.
Who makes the decision precisely where the monitors go?
The state does, subject to EPA approval. And I should stress that it's a case-by-case analysis, and there are opportunities for the public to comment on particular monitoring locations, and EPA's approval of a monitoring network is subject to challenge. So the issue, to the extent that petitioners are speculating here, that, well, possibly notwithstanding EPA's regulations, a particular monitor could be located in some very unique location and unreasonably compared to the annual max, that issue's not ripe for review. They could challenge that at a later date. In short, the near road monitoring network is eminently reasonable and appropriate, and it should be upheld. Does the court have any further questions on that issue? Unless the court has questions on any of the other ancillary issues, we would request that the standards be upheld in their entirety.
Thank you. Mr. Wareham, you were out of time, but you can take 1 minute if you'd like it.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. First of all, I'd like to correct a citation earlier. I refer to the Clean Air Act procedural provisions. I believe I said 112D6, and that, of course, is Section 307D, not 112D. My apologies, Your Honors. With regard to near road monitoring, we believe that the agency's decision to cite near road monitors is arbitrary because by EPA's own regulations, monitors must be sited in locations that are representative of area-wide exposure.
Do you think people don't live near major roads?
Your Honor, the only evidence that the agency put into the record, which indicated the population that may live in proximity to roads, is a Census Bureau report that only appeared in the record at the time of the final rulemaking. It was not available during the...
But what about counsel's point that this requirement only applies in major urban areas?
That's true, Your Honor, but...
Do you think there may be major urban areas where people don't live near major roads?
That may well be, but there's no evidence in the record that allows us to make that determination or to submit comments on that, Your Honor. Getting back to the standard setting, I'd just like to make two quick points, Your Honors.
Really quickly?
Yes, very quickly. What the agency essentially is saying is we've looked at enough other studies that we don't need to look at yours, and that we just disagree with that. Again, we submitted studies to the record in support of arguments made on the record. The agency did not respond to those studies. We believe the agency has an express responsibility to do that under 307D, and its failure to respond to the studies is fatal to their standard-setting process, notwithstanding the weight of the other evidence that they did consider. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Lieutenant. The case is submitted.